I don't think going out on a date make you a slut, but having sex with different men makes you a slut.
Well, what does it make you if you have sex with different women?
A slut maker. By popular demand, slut maker t-shirt, now available, thefallenstate.tv, #, slut maker, thefallenstate.tv. The Fallen State is amazing. Subscribe now. Welcome to The Fallen State. I'm Jesse Lee Peterson. Thank you so much for being with me. I have with me in studio on the set of The Fallen State, Dinesh D'Souza, and I've interviewed him before on my radio show, and it's an honor to have you here in person. Dinesh is a filmmaker, author, and his latest film, The Death of a Nation, that comes out on August 3rd, 2018. Thank you for coming.
Good to be on the show.
I totally appreciate it. Are you nervous?
No.
Are you not nervous?
No.
You better be. No, I'm kidding. Congratulations on this film.
Thank you.
Yeah, I saw it, and it's very, very Mamma Mia interesting.
Thank you very much.
You know what I wanted to ask you about The Death of the Nation as I was watching it? How do we, like we regular folks, how do we know what the truth is? Because the people on the left are saying one thing, the people in the middle are saying another one, the people on the right are saying another one. How do I, as an individual, would know what the real truth is?
That's a good question, because conventional wisdom in America today about not just the news of the day, but even the story of America,
yeah,
is shaped by, you could call it, progressive history. And what I mean by this is that starting really in the middle of the last century, a group of people who call themselves progressives or liberals, some leftists, became increasingly dominant in academia and the media and Hollywood,
right,
the entertainment industry. And so they became the storytellers, you might say, of America. And they put out a big story.
Yes.
And parts of that story are distorted, and other parts of it are completely untrue. But the conservatives who figured that out never had big enough megaphones to contest it.
Right.
And so this is the reason I got into movies. I've been most of my career a writer, a scholar, a think tank guy, a speaker. But I realized, wow, it's really important to get this information out to people. Now, I think the good advantage of living today is that when you see two contradictory narratives, particularly two competing facts,
yes,
you are actually in a position yourself to check it out. And when I speak on campus, or when people see my movies and they go, how do I know that's true? I go, focus on the factual part of it, and then look it up. And today you can get information pretty quickly, as long as you know where to look. And I think you're in a position yourself to be the judge and the jury for which side is telling the truth.
Define progressive.
So the progressives are, this is a movement that started about 100 years ago. Its initial leader was Woodrow Wilson.
Right.
He was the first progressive president. But I think it would be fair to say that Woodrow Wilson, FDR, LBJ are the three sort of great progressive figures of the 20th century, and they are all in the same tradition. The fundamental idea of progressivism is that the American founding was flawed. We have to make progress, meaning we have to move forward away from it, away from the founding, and we do it by increasing the power of the centralized state. That's the core meaning of progressivism.
And would that be the same as, for those who don't know, understand, would that be the same as the Democrats?
Yeah, the Democrats.
Does progressive mean Democrat?
The Democrats became the party of progressivism.
Oh, okay.
And they were sort of the party of progressivism under Wilson, but Wilson had a mixed success. With FDR, progressivism became the official doctrine of the Democratic Party, and that's continued all the way to the present.
And when you say the progressives believe that America made a mistake or had done so, what was the mistake that America made in their minds?
The core mistake of America, according to the progressives, was the idea that you can leave it to the free market and to the individual to live their own life.
Oh, I see.
That the free market by itself would create economically prosperous and stable society, and that individuals could be trusted to know what was best for them. This they saw as the founders' belief, and the progressives went, that doesn't work. We need to have a group of people smart, like us, to regulate society, to direct its course, to morally educate people to be good citizens. And so the centralized state became to be seen as sort of the conscience of the nation. And FDR, of course, jumped on this. And the New Deal, the Great Society, Obama, it's all in the line of increasing the power of the state.
Did they really believe that, or did they say that so that they can take control of the people?
Both. It's a fundamental fact of human psychology that people tend to believe things that are there in their own interest.
Oh, yeah.
And so when something benefits you, you are likely to believe that's a good way to go. So if you look at all these progressives, they were journalists, they were lawyers, they were professors. In a world of free markets, they're not the top dog. The top dog are the entrepreneurs, the people coming up with the iPhone, the people who are shaping the new products that drive us. So these guys were very envious and resentful of the entrepreneurial class. And so they formed a rival class that is with us today. So today when people talk about the media, the deep state, what they're really talking about is a knowledge class of people who see themselves as better suited to run society than the businessmen of America.
I noticed that even in your movie, but I've seen this on my own, that the progressive, the Democrat, the liberals, they tend to get their message out better than the right. And that they use words that can seduce you. You know, they'll change the word. If one word doesn't work, they quickly change it to something that if you're not aware, you would identify with the word, and then you'll find yourself going along with them. Have you noticed that?
Yes, and you have to see, look, if a guy goes into business, right, he's making oil or he's making soap, his concern is with the product.
Right.
And his concern is making sure that this product, the iPhone, fits into your pocket, is easy to see, you can text on it, you can do this, you can do that. Now, the progressives come out of the knowledge class. Their product is words. That's what they trade in.
Yes.
So they've become very good.
They're very good at it.
Yeah, and they also recognize the power of emotion. So
yes.
Many conservatives foolishly say, oh, well, I want to stay away from emotion to just give you the facts. This whole immigration debate, they understand that the way to fight the immigration debate is not to argue about statistics and data. Do immigrants contribute to American productivity? No. What they want is they want to show a picture of some guy in a uniform pulling a kid away from its mother and go, look at these horrible, evil people and what they do.
The children. You're absolutely right. And then you get caught up with that emotionally and find yourself agreeing with the Democrats going against your own interests.
Right, because the Democrats almost appear to be, in this episode, the party of family values, calling for
That's
family
amazing.
Reunification. So they're very good at it, and we have to get better at it. And so again, when I make movies, I recognize that movies should be entertaining. They should be emotionally powerful.
Yeah.
They should be funny,
if
they can be. They should be eye-opening. They should make your jaw drop. They should be moving. They should inspire you.
That's how the death of a nation is. It's very, very interesting. You want to watch the whole thing. Why is it that the people on the right are not as... Because they do try to give out all these stats and all this stuff. And then when they don't give them out, the people on the left say, you're not giving stats. What are your proof, right? And so it seems as though the people on the right are trying to appease the people on the left, where the people on the left does not appease the people on the right. What is wrong with the people on the right?
Well, I think it's important to realize that when you're in a debate with somebody, and I've done a lot of debates, I've debated Jesse Jackson, Walter Mondale, many others over the years, you're not trying to convince your opponent.
Right.
Right?
That's
you're
right.
trying to convince the middle guy in the audience who is on the fence.
Yeah.
So many conservatives, they miss this. So the left hits them with all this stuff, and half of it is a trap. And they feel like, I got to convince that guy.
And
no,
do.
You don't have to convince that guy. What you have to do is appeal to the hypothetical man in the middle and make arguments that will win that person over. So I think that you need knowledge, you need data. I mean, that's why I write the books that go with the movie.
Right.
My book, Death of a Nation, it has all the footnotes, all the references. So I show all the shocking stuff in the movie. I mean, you know, there's a meeting of the senior Nazis.
Oh, yeah.
And they're passing the Nuremberg laws, which discriminate against Jews. And they've got in their hands the Democratic Jim Crow laws.
Right. That was amazing
to
see that.
And that's not in any textbook. It's because the textbooks are written by progressives today. They leave it out. But this is why it's important. If someone comes to me and goes, Dinesh, prove it. I go, look, I've got dozens of references.
Yeah.
It's all there. I even have a transcript of the meeting. So this is not a matter of I say this, this is my truth, and you have your truth. No, this is an actual historical episode that the Nazis actually used the Democratic laws. And they basically crossed out the word black and wrote in the word Jew.
Yeah.
And that's how they did it. And that's history. And there it is for you to check out.
And you're right. When I debate, I don't try to prove anything to my opponent. Even when they're attacking me, calling me Uncle Tom, the N-word, it doesn't matter. I'm trying to reach the person that's listening or watching the discussion. Define nationalism for me. You talked about that a lot in the movie. Explain to me and an audience, what is nationalism? And is it a bad thing?
So nationalism is the allegiance, the love that you have not just for your country in the abstract, but for your countrymen.
Right.
And by and large, nations are collections of peoples who have something in common. It isn't just a geographic border. Because typically in a nation, particularly a nation that's been around for a while, you have a common way of life that develops,
yes,
right?
Yes.
And so when you talk to a fellow citizen, you have references that you can appeal to. Leave It to Beaver and the 60s and the Beatles and, you know, and the Little League games and the Boston Celtics. So this is the American common experience.
Yes.
So we are a nation, and it's not just that we have a Constitution, a Declaration of Independence. We have a common way of life that makes us Americans. Now,
right.
This is actually true, and everybody knows it's true. If two Americans see each other on the streets of the Champs-Élysées in Paris, they immediately recognize each other because they recognize the Americanness of each other.
Yes.
Now, so that's nationalism. Now, nationalism can take different forms. It can be benign. Sometimes it can be toxic. So Hitler's nationalism was toxic because Hitler basically goes, not only are we the Germans, but we're the best. Everybody else is inferior. Hitler's nationalism was so peculiar that even within Germany, he goes, the Jews who are here, they're not really Germans. So they don't count in our nationalism. So this was the sort of, you could call it fascist nationalism.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, Gandhi in India was a nationalist.
Right.
Mandela in South Africa was a nationalist. Winston Churchill was a nationalist. So when people try to say Trump is a fascist because he's a nationalist, that doesn't make any sense.
Right.
You have to prove he was a certain type of nationalist. And in fact, if you ask what type of nationalist, well, Hitler called himself a national socialist.
Oh, yeah,
right.
Sure. Yeah.
So when Hitler's nationalism married nationalism and socialism, that was the key to it. And that's what the progressives try to muddy the waters about, because they don't want us to identify National Socialism on the left.
Right.
They try to pin it on the right.
What type of nationalist do you believe that President Trump is a nationalist, right?
Yes.
And so what type is he?
He's not even an intellectual nationalist in the sense that he's
not
immersed in readings of him. No,
right.
He doesn't read Walt Whitman poems. No, he is an instinctive nationalist. And by that, I mean, he's a guy who grew up in Queens. He likes America. He likes the American people. He likes the American way of life. He's a patriot. He likes capitalism. He thinks that it unleashes animal spirits. It brings out the best in people.
Yes.
He's a builder. So I think that's Trump's nationalism. Now, the left tries to portray Trump's nationalism as racial. And the way they do that is they go, he's against Muslims. He's against immigrants. Now, first of all, even if it were true that Trump was against Muslims, that's not racial because Muslims are not a race.
Right.
But if Trump is saying, I'm not against Muslims, I just don't want dangerous people coming in this country, there's nothing racist about that.
Right. That's right.
Now, Trump makes a distinction between the legal and the illegal immigrant, right? Now, if all the illegals were non-white and all the legals were white, then you could make an argument that he's making a racial line.
Right.
But the fact of the matter is, America lets in 1 million legal immigrants every year. Most of them are coming from Asia, Africa, South America, the Caribbean. So they're not white. So Trump is not drawing a racial line. And you'll notice that whenever the left covers immigration, they always blur the line between the legal and the illegal. They'll say things like, you know, Trump is sending, you know, immigrant children home. Right. No, he's not sending immigrant children home. He's sending the children of illegals.
That's right.
So that's a totally different thing. And that's why I say Trump's nationalism is actually a multiracial nationalism rooted in the American experience.
I see things because I was raised that way. I think I'm a nationalist because all my life I believed in America. I believe in entrepreneurship. I love my country. I want to put my country first. And that's what attracts me to President Trump is that he believed the way I believe. And so when he said he was running, I said, right on, this man will become the next president. So am I a nationalist, and can a black person be one?
Yes, and so can a non-white guy like me. Look, I'm an immigrant, right? So I'm America's my adopted country.
Yeah.
And so I'm always pay attention whenever I hear all this stuff that people say, America was built by immigrants. No,
it wasn't true.
Not true.
Right.
Some people build a country, and when it becomes an attractive country, immigrants come to it.
Right.
But the immigrants didn't build it.
That's right.
You know, somebody else built it.
Yeah.
So America was actually built by settlers. It was built by blacks. It was built. Immigrants helped, of course, but they were not the original builders. The country was built. The immigrants looked at their own country and they go, things aren't so good over here. Things are really good over there.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to get on the boat and take all the risk it takes to leave your family and leave your friends, leave the whole world you knew. So my patriotism is rooted in a kind of American nationalism, same as yours.
You interviewed Richard Spencer, and I was thinking about this as well. I've interviewed Richard before as well, and Richard is a nationalist, right? You agree?
He's a particular type of nationalist. Yes.
Right. The only thing I noticed about Richard and I spoke to him about it during the interview, I think that he's right in what he believes and what he wants, and especially since white Americans have been so under attack for so long. But I told Richard he needed to drop the anger. Because white people have been suppressed, they've been accused, and they've been blamed for everything. And so the young white men are angry about that, so they're coming out fighting with the anger, which allows the media and others to make them look like the bad guys. Do you disagree? Do you agree with me on that?
Well, I would put it this way. I think that, as you know, there were anger movements in the 60s that drove...
Let me ask this first.
Yeah.
Do you see Richard Spencer as a bad guy?
I see him as a misguided guy who's on the left. In other words, when I say on the left, here's what I mean. Number one, he believes in identity politics. Identity politics is this. Identity politics is the belief that the most important thing about you is what ethnic group or race you belong to. Now, see, I don't believe that.
Right.
But he believes that.
I don't know. I think he only believes that because they've been so, white guys especially, and especially white straight men, been so under attack. And they've been prevented from speaking up for the last 60 years or so. Everybody accused. I just think they're mad about the way they've been treated.
Right, but
and
I mean,
in that fallen state, they're coming out like that.
Agreed, but remember, like I would say that the angry nationalism of, say, Malcolm X came in response to what he saw as white nationalism.
Sure did.
Right, and Malcolm X goes, "If we don't fight back as a group," and so now Richard is the next turn of the screw, and so he represents a kind of bitter. White nationalism responding to what he sees as the minority nationalism.
Yeah.
He goes, well, we have black power, we have Latino power, we have this power, we have that power. Why can't we have white power?
Right.
That's basically his argument.
I agree.
You know, and but I don't think Trump's on that bandwagon at all.
Not at all.
Trump is we're Americans first.
Right.
And that's what we have in common. And I think that's actually the future of the Republican Party. That was also Reagan. That was the Reaganite conservatism. I became a conservative in the 80s. And Trump, I think, is continuous with that.
What was your feeling in the room with Richard when you were talking to him? What did you get from him?
Well, the funny thing is, we're talking about Richard Spencer now, that's sort of the poster boy of white supremacy, you might say. So my wife Debbie's from Venezuela, and both of us were like, oh, Richard Spencer, white supremacist. You know, we were like, do we need security? But when you meet the guy, he couldn't seem more harmless.
Right. Yeah.
He's dressed in a little tweed jacket.
Yeah.
He's shy. Yeah. He's well-spoken. And so I treated him firmly but respectfully. And what I was trying to get at was this, and that is that the left is always trying to portray these guys as being the quintessential Trumpster.
I know, man.
And what I tried to show is, listen, Richard, you know, you and Trump actually do not agree on much. So, for example, I said to Richard, you know, I said, Trump is drawing a line between the legal and the illegal immigrant, right? What's your line? You know, do you want more immigration or less immigration? You've got an immigrant like me. Now, I'm a citizen. I've been a citizen since 1991. What would you do with me? Would you send me home? So I was pressing Richard on all these kinds of points
it
in order to expose
interview.
He's got a totally different ideology than Trump.
We started White History Month. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
July is White History Month now. We started this year for the first time. And it's just been amazing at the people's response to the idea of White History Month. When you hear me say that, what's the first thing you think and feel about it?
Well, my immediate reaction to it is to sort of chuckle. Because, of course, I think I know why you're doing it.
Yeah.
And you're doing something that conservatives rarely do, which is you're sort of playing the game of the left in order to take them on. So a lot of times, guys on our side, they go, listen, the other side is doing all these evil tactics, right? Our job is not to be like them.
So,
so you, like, take the Supreme Court. The left goes, whenever they get a court appointee, they ask only one question. Is he a good Democratic leftist?
Yes.
Why? Because they're looking for a vote that they can count on 100%. We say, we're looking for a guy who has very good intellectual credentials.
I know.
We're looking for a guy who loves and respects the Constitution. Yeah. We're looking for somebody who wants to look at the original intentions of the founders, right? So they're picking Democrats, and we're picking on some other basis.
Yeah.
And as a result, we've had the majority of nominees on the court now since Reagan, right? But we don't have the court. Why not? Because it's like, let's see what Anthony Kennedy is going to do today.
Yeah.
Hey, we got Kennedy. Whoops, we lost Roberts. You know? So as a result, we're not, it's like we are coming to this fight, right? They come heavily armed with armor, bulletproof vests, and so on. And we basically come and say it's a gentleman's quarrel.
I know.
You know, and I think you and I recognize that we have to fight a little differently. Not that we have to be them, but
right.
We just have to be a little more aware of what we're up against.
And another reason that I did it is because they have so-called Black History Month, Women History Month, Mexican History Month, Japanese History Month, Homosexual History Month, everybody History Month but white folks. And I said that it was white folks who started this country, who founded this country, who created the Constitution. And anytime you hear about white history or American history, it's in a negative way now. It makes you want to hate the white people rather than appreciate them. And so I started so that we could be reminded of the people who made this possible, how great this country is. And I've noticed that it kind of awakened people. They're shocked. They're like, yeah, that's right. Because they're afraid, white people are afraid to bring up white history for fear of being called racist. And black people and others don't bring it up because either they don't know it or they hate white people or they don't want to do it. And I'm concerned that if we don't be reminded of the people who made it possible and how great this country is, we're going to lose the country.
Yeah, so a lot of my work in recent years has been aimed at zooming into this very point by telling a little different story of America that is happens to be true. I'll give you an example. So the left has been very clever about taking the crimes of America, right, and pushing them on the founding. The founders did it.
Yeah.
Now, you would think, if you read most textbooks, that the vast system of plantation slavery throughout the American South, 4 million slaves at its peak, this was created by the founding. The truth of it is, in the founding, there weren't a whole lot of plantations.
That's right.
The agriculture in the South was very diversified. It was right around the year 1800 when the cotton gin was invented that cotton became King Cotton.
Right.
Right? So it wasn't until the 1820s that you began to have really a network of plantations throughout the South. And isn't it interesting that in the 1820s a new political party founded, happened to name itself the Democratic Party,
right,
that became the champion of the slave plantation,
yeah,
and the plantation owners. And this wasn't just the Southern Democrats, the Northern Democrats and the Southern Democrats worked together.
Yeah.
Lincoln knew this. So now the left now, because they know it too, they're like, listen, we don't want the blame to fall on the Democratic Party. So let us push it back further.
I saw that. That's
and
amazing.
Let's nail the founders.
Yeah.
It's a big lie. In reality, if you look at all the Southerners in the founding, Jefferson, Madison, Washington, all three of them fierce denouncers of slavery.
Yep.
So you have plantation owners, yeah, they have slaves, but they are very ambivalent about slavery. Jefferson actually introduces legislation to end slavery. And so, but once the Democratic Party starts, all that goes away.
Yep.
You try to find, you show me Democratic Southerners in the 1820s and 30s who want to abolish slavery, they don't exist.
You made that so clear in the movie. I hope that everybody and their mama see this documentary. It needs to be played in all of the public schools and everywhere. I grew up on a plantation down in Alabama. I was born on a plantation outside of Montgomery. And when I hear and I grew up under the Jim Crow laws, right? But when I hear the history of that, it's nothing like what really happened. They present it in a way that is all lies. It makes you angry. And it wasn't like that. It wasn't even the mentality of black people. Black people in those days, they knew that all white people were not against them. They taught us that there's good and evil in all people, and that the Jim Crow law was a government law created by the Democratic Party, because most black people in those days were Republicans, and they were not Democrats. And so they didn't teach us that all white people was for the Jim Crow law. But when you hear it coming from the left, it seemed as though all white people were bad, and all black people were just suffering. You know, that they were being hung KKK, and none of that is true. It's just so made up.
So this is what I call the big lie, and the big lie is actually a term invented by Hitler, and Hitler basically says big lies are easier to sell than small lies, and the Democrats have really pushed this big lie.
Yes.
When Lincoln, named the three, Lincoln named the four horsemen of the apocalypse, the four bad guys of slavery, right? And he named them. Three of them were Northern Democrats. And I say this because the left has done so much to blame the South.
Yes.
That we forget the role of the Northern Democrats. So Franklin Pierce, the former president, from New Hampshire.
Yeah.
Buchanan, the sitting president at that time, from Pennsylvania. And Stephen Douglas, Lincoln's great antagonist, from Illinois. So these are Northern Democrats conspiring with the Southern Democrats to protect slavery.
Yeah.
So, my movies are partly historical, but then they also bring you to the present.
I thought you did a good job on that, showing the Southern Democrats and the Northern Democrat and the commonality that they have. I kind of heard about the Northern ones and that they put the blacks into projects and stuff like that, but you made it so clear in the movie, and I really appreciate that. Stood out.
The other thing the Northern Democrats did, and this has become the formula for the Democrats today, is they invented the Northern, I call it the Northern urban plantation.
Yeah.
And what That's I right. mean by that is that the Northern Democrats realize we don't have slaves, but we do have poor immigrants.
Yeah.
And, some of them don't speak English, they're poor, they're destitute, they're helpless. They're sort of like slaves in that if we can get them, in a sense, under our control, if we can own them, then we will. This time they weren't stealing their labor, but they were stealing their vote.
It's a must-see documentary. But I want to move on to some other things because we're running out of time. Two quick things about the documentary that I had not realized. You showed the Antifa today, the people who dress in dark black, and then you showed them during Hitler's days, and like they were both doing the same thing. That's mind-blowing to me. I had never seen that comparison.
Well, Hitler had a private militia called the Brown Shirts. Mussolini, the other fascist dictator, had a private militia called the Black Shirts. Now, so if you look at the Mussolini Black Shirts, and you put them side by side with Antifa, you can't tell the difference.
Right. Yeah.
And they all both carry sticks, they both carry truncheons, they both have the same goal, which is they find people who don't agree with them, they want to beat them up, disrupt them, prevent them from speaking. So it's ironic. I mean, fascism was originally on the left, and we're seeing now this fascist tactics adopted by the left.
It's amazing, too, because the media here in this country, the media can make Antifa look like the friend and made the guys on the right look like the enemies. Like the nationalists, they're made to look like the bad people, and Antifa look like the good people. That's mind-blowing to me.
Well, you know, Trump talks about fake news. I talk about fake scholarship, fake history. So that's what I mean when behind the daily stories of the media are these meta stories. They're the big stories behind the stories.
Yeah.
And deconstructing those meta stories is kind of what I do.
I want to ask you this about Hitler before we move away from him. A lot of Americans, especially white Americans, are being told that they've been lied to about this whole Hitler and the Jewish thing. I don't know where they're getting this information from, and I don't know if it's true or not. Was Hitler wrong for what? For being angry? His anger justified, even though he may or may not carry out the bad? I don't know. But was he wrong for being mad at the Jews?
Hitler was a veteran of World War I. And you have to remember that in World War I, after the war, Germany was destroyed. And after the destruction of Germany came the Treaty of Versailles that put very harsh terms on the Germans. They had to turn over parts of their country to the French. They had to pay reparations and war debt. Inflation was astronomical.
The Germans had to do this?
The Germans had to do this.
Uh-huh.
What Hitler tapped into was the widespread anger in Germany over what they saw. See, the Germans had made a treaty with the Allies, and they thought they were going to get generous terms.
Right.
But they got very harsh terms. And the whole of Germany was outraged. And Hitler was able to tap into that vein of anger, which he shared, to basically say to the Germans, you know, we are a great people, we have been screwed, and we need to come back with a vengeance, and we can only trust ourselves, and we need to build up our arms because we can trust nothing else except our own strength. So Hitler's militarism came out of that. Now, Hitler kind of needed a target in Germany that he could blame for what went wrong. And I think wrongly, very cunningly, Hitler selected the Jews because the Jews were powerful in Germany. They were in banking, they were in finance, and so Hitler basically said, you know, and this you can see the left-wingness of Hitler here. Hitler goes, these are the greedy swindlers. These are the capitalists. These are the people who run the whole country. It's very similar to what Elizabeth Warren and Bernie say about Wall Street.
Right.
It's that kind of rhetoric, that these people don't produce anything. They are leeches on the economy. They're swindling you out of your hard-earned wages. And so basically Hitler called for state control over the economy to restore justice in Germany. So this was a national socialist agenda, and it's very easy to verify.
So Hitler was a German, and he was white. And Germans are white people, right?
Correct. And Hitler was originally from Austria, but yes, he was. He moved to Germany.
And so did Hitler feel the same type of anger that white men and some young white women are feeling today in America?
Yes, although the situations are totally different. Because, see, today we have multiculturalism. Basically, if you take Richard Spencer, right? If Richard Spencer were any color other than white and said exactly what he did, he would fit right in the Democratic Party.
He'd fit
right in. He could show up at the multicultural picnic and say, let's say that Richard Spencer belonged to another race called purple. And Richard Spencer said, purple power. We want to unify all the purple people. We want to have Purple History Month. The Democrats would be like, this is wonderful. You know, come right in. Join our group. But because multiculturalism is aimed against the white man, Spencer's left out of it, and his movement comes out of that.
So now that I have White History Month going, would they let me in?
Well, for them, White History Month has to be a sequence of unending apologies,
right.
And confessions and pulling out your hair and so on.
Yeah.
Look, I find the whole thing just preposterous because, see, the problem isn't whiteness, right? Take the Civil War. There were white guys fighting on both sides,
yeah,
right? 300,000 right. White guys on the right side, 300,000 white guys on the wrong side.
Yeah.
And so if anybody looks at that and goes, the problem with that is whiteness, they need to have their head examined.
I know. It's so amazing. So you went to jail. Were you in prison or jail?
Well, I went to
Obama put you in jail. Were you surprised?
I'm probably more surprised than most other people who end up in jail. Nothing I did warranted that. You know, I exceeded the campaign finance
right.
law. And typically for that, you get community service and a fine. In fact, to be honest, what I did, the amount involved was so small. And since I had no corruption, no motive, it's normally not even prosecuted. Rosie O'Donnell just exceeded the campaign finance law 5 times.
Yeah.
No one's even talking
about
this.
Look at Al Sharpton. He doesn't even pay his taxes.
That's a whole different story. But, you know, I made the movie on Obama. I upset him.
Yeah.
You know, in a weird way, I took that as a measure of making a good movie, because if you, you know, if you can make a movie that has that kind of impact, where the guy who's in the movie wants to go after you, so that encouraged me to make more movies.
So, did you ever imagine I'm making this movie? What was it called? Obama America, right?
2016 Obama's America.
Yeah. Did you ever think, while making this movie, one day Obama gonna put me in jail?
No. I did not think that. In fact, it was a new thing for me. I didn't even know if the movie would make the theaters, if it would get out there. We opened the movie in 4 theaters.
Yeah.
And had it done poorly, it would have shut down right there.
Right.
But it caught a wind. It did well. It expanded to more theaters. I think what really got to Obama wasn't just that I was critical of him. It was that here I was. You know, Obama was going around the country and saying, "We are our brother's keeper."
Right.
Remember that?
I remember that.
So I was in Kenya, and I found his brother, George. And he was living in a slum, you know, walking through the mud to get out of his hut. And so I sat down with him in the slum and interviewed him. I said, you know, Obama says that we are brother's keeper. Now, what is he doing to keep you?
Right.
This guy goes, well, he hasn't lifted a finger to help me. And so, you know, I exposed the hypocrisy and just the sheer, you know, the audacity with which people who would never dream of opening their doors, we don't need a wall, we don't need a fence. But of course, if anyone shows up at their house, they can get in.
That's right. So were you in jail or prison?
I was in something else called a confinement center. A confinement center is a jail for people who are basically serving long prison sentences. They've almost completed their time. But before they go on the street, they're sent to this confinement center. And I had to stay there. I didn't stay there in the day, but I had to check in at 7 p.m. overnight and check out in the morning.
Oh, I see. Were you afraid in there?
Oddly, I was protected by the fact that we were not in a cell. If I was in a cell, I'd be with one other guy, right?
Uh-huh.
But I was in a dorm. And a dorm, a room about this size, 60 beds, 2 floors, so 60 apiece, 120 felons in the room. I mean, I can't say I slept all that well. The first, certainly in the beginning, I slept with one eye open. But over time, I got okay with it. I realized there are ways to be. You have to be sensible, you know.
Right, of course.
So I would dress the part. And I was low key, and I was careful. You know, some guy would come up and say, you know, can I borrow $5? Now you have to realize you have to be careful how you answer, because if you say yes, then he's going to be back for more money. If you say no, he could take it as an insult. You have to think, how do I deal with those situations?
So what did you say? No, sir, I'm from India. I don't have any money.
See, that's a pretty good one. That would have been pretty good. I said, hey, I don't have it.
Yeah.
And so. That was probably the best answer.
I imagine you there, because we talked about it on the show, and I thought he's going to come out of there with a movie about being in there and educating the people while in there. Did they know who you were? Anybody in there knew who you were?
Not the inmates. The guards did.
Oh.
Because, in fact, what happened was I'd come to New York for a judicial hearing. I'd gone to the Megyn Kelly show on Fox News Channel in those days. And one of the guards saw me. He's like, what? This guy? What?
Yeah.
You know, so when I came back the next day, he's like, were you on TV? I was like, well, yeah. And so he told everybody else. So the authorities knew, but the guys inside, unless I told someone, they didn't know.
Oh, okay. When did you realize about yourself while there? Did you learn anything about yourself that you had not realized before?
Well, first of all, I realized that... I realized that this was exposing me to a whole America I'd never seen before.
Yes.
I also realized that somebody like me with my own type of background, I mean, this was such a different environment. In fact, my publisher, a young guy with a similar background to me, he said to me, he goes, Dinesh, I could not survive in there. He goes, it is such a different place.
It sure is.
I mean, it's basically, you're basically in with thugs, you know?
That's right.
And he goes, I would just melt, you know? But I realized, no, I actually have, and I think I get this from my mom, a little inner serenity and toughness that I think has held me in good stead. I also realized at the end of the day, American politics is not a debating game.
Right.
You actually have, and I think we've seen this in recent years, a kind of a gangsterization of the Democratic Party.
And we
again, have to be a little aware of that and sort of go on as if this is just a debate in which they believe in, we believe in liberty, they believe in equality. It's to miss the reality of the situation.
How long was your sentence?
8 months.
And then the Great White Hope comes along and pardon you. Were you surprised?
How did that happen? You know, I was, how did it happen?
Well, tell me first, were you surprised?
I was surprised.
Okay.
I remember, unlike you, I was not an original Trumpster. In fact, I stayed out of the primaries.
I'll let him know that so he can put you back in there.
Oh, yes. Once Trump became the nominee, I was on board.
Oh, okay.
But I would have been on board right. if Ted Cruz was the nominee.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I thought there was a good chance I would get pardoned. But see, sometimes the president will wait until the end.
Right.
So I was very lucky that Trump decided to do it now. So I'm very grateful that happened, yeah. and it's unleashed me in a new way.
So did someone speak on your behalf to the president? Like, you know, this guy's in there, he's a good guy, Obama hated him, and he shouldn't be there.
A lot of people on social media were petitioning Trump. Hey, pardon this guy. This is stupid. This makes no sense. Well, finally, Senator Ted Cruz went to Trump and he said, "You have to pardon Dinesh D'Souza."
Oh, good.
And according to Senator Cruz, Trump just looked over in the limousine and said, "Done."
Right on.
And it was like that.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was really funny. Even when he called me, he was very Trumpian, his usual kind of amusing self. The whole thing was very funny.
So the president called you?
Yeah, I was in my study. And the phone rings, I pick it up, it's the White House operator. She goes, "Hold a line for the President of the United States."
Amazing.
I'm like, whoa. So Trump comes in and he goes, hey. He goes, "You know, I'm sitting here with John Kelly." He goes, "You know John Kelly?" I'm like, "I don't know John Kelly. I know who he is, but no, I don't know the guy." So it was like that, a very jovial kind of conversation.
Wow. Well, I'm glad they got you out. Let you out. Congratulations.
Thank you.
That. Are you a Christian?
Yes.
You're a Christian. Do you believe that human beings are in a fallen state?
Yes, in the sense that I believe that we have a line between good and evil that runs through every human heart.
Yeah.
And so there is a fallen side of human nature, for sure.
Yeah. Oh, first I want to just ask, I forgot to ask, when President Trump released you, didn't you send Obama a note like, "Nah, nah, 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 ha, ha, ha"?
You know what? I didn't do that, but believe me, I was tempted to send notes to my judge, my prosecutor, Eric Holder, all these guys. I have to admit that part of my amusement, I mean, initially I was just relieved and I had all the positive emotions. When the negative emotions started kicking in, I was actually fantasizing and imagining the face of my judge.
Yeah.
This is a Clinton appointee judge. You know, this guy, by the way, sentenced me to psychiatric examination from my crime, as if I'm like Jeffrey Dahmer, you know?
Amazing.
So this is how these people are. This is how they think.
They're evil.
And so anyway, all's well that ends well.
It does. I'm a Christian too, and I believe that our battle is a spiritual battle, that it's a warfare between good and evil. It has nothing to do with the physical. And that, you know, the Bible says that we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against spirits and principalities and wickedness in high places. And so in my book, The Antidote, I prove that there's no such thing as racism, no such thing as racism, sexism, homophobiaism, Islamophobiaism, no isms. That's what the children of the lie speaks. And that's why we can't resolve the problem, because it's an illusion. Our battle is a spiritual problem. It's either right or wrong, good or evil. And I think we as Christians should stop using the language of the children of the lie and speak the truth so that we can resolve these issues. Either you're right or you're wrong. It has nothing to do with male or female. When I was growing up down in Alabama on that plantation, the word racism didn't even exist. It was either right or wrong. Do you see and agree with what I'm saying, that it's a spiritual thing and not a physical one?
Yeah, if I understand you correctly, I agree completely. I agree that here's the political realm over here. And underneath that is a moral realm. And underneath that is a spiritual realm.
Yes.
Right? I absolutely agree with that. And I think that our political problems are a manifestation of deeper moral problems.
Yes. Yes, sir.
And our moral problems themselves are a reflection of a deeper spiritual crisis.
Yes.
So in that sense, I think that's why I'm like blown away when I hear Christians say things like, "Oh, well, I cannot get involved in society." And this is nonsense.
I mean, the
Christians are the salt and light of the earth and have to be actively involved in politics. You know, the American Revolution occurred because preachers were urging people to go out and fight.
Yes.
And there is a famous scene in Massachusetts of one of the leading preachers who, in the middle of his sermon, while he's preaching about the necessity of the revolution, he essentially, he's wearing a kind of a cassock, almost like a priest, and he unzips his cassock and he's in military uniform underneath that.
Yeah.
So this line between politics and spirituality is the early champions of the American Revolution saw spiritual conviction as fortifying the revolutionary spirit.
I hate to talk about the movement some more because I would tell the whole thing. Would you rather me not ask any more about the movie itself?
Oh, no. Feel free to talk about it.
I thought you did a remarkable thing in the movie when you compare President Trump to Abraham Lincoln. That was mind-blowing to me. And it shows that men who believe in God, it doesn't matter what century it is or generation it is, it's the same spirit of goodness and power and authority that's operating. And I thought that was an excellent job you did.
Well, one of the reasons people feel emotionally resistant to these analogies is they feel like that Lincoln was kind of a superhuman, you know, and so who can be compared to Lincoln? But when you actually study Lincoln up close, you see the actual humanity of Lincoln's situation.
Right.
And in fact, even some of the things said about Trump, you know, he's an idiot, he's a buffoon. That's how Lincoln was viewed. When
right.
Lincoln first came in, there's a woman, Mary Chestnut, who's the wife of Senator Chestnut, who was the senator from South Carolina, Democrats. And Mary Chestnut, a very intelligent woman, she keeps a diary called Diary from Dixie. And she's writing about Lincoln. She goes, every time I look at Lincoln, she goes, I'm appalled. The man's a total buffoon. All he does is he tells these ridiculous stories. He's not a serious man. And unfortunately, this is a serious time. But the North has elected this clown, you know. And I chuckle when I read this because we're not used to we hear people who don't like Lincoln, but we don't hear Lincoln described as a buffoon.
Right.
But that's how she saw him. And so that was in the politics of the moment. And the situations facing Trump and Lincoln are eerily similar.
I know. That
right?
was mind-blowing.
An outsider gets elected. A major party goes berserk. They won't accept the election. They're willing to even... They want to kill him, but if they can't get rid of him, they'll break up the country. But they will... They're going to overturn the result no matter what. I mean, and it's the same party.
Yes.
In both cases, the Democratic Party.
So is that history repeated itself? That's what that means? Or is that a
made-up
thing?
Well, history does not repeat itself in identical forms. But what it does mean is that you can learn from episodes in the past that are illuminating about the present.
Yeah.
I believe that's why we study history.
What is a man besides the body part? What is a man?
I would say that we in the kind of hierarchy of things we have the animals, and then we have the angels up in heaven. So man is this intermediate creature that is animal in his structure, but has a spark of the divine. And so we are this compound hybrid of divinity and animality, you might say. And so there's always a human nature struggling to better itself.
Yes. Are men different from women?
Yes, men are different from women, and men are more different from women than, say, blacks are different from whites.
Right.
I remember someone used the phrase about race that it's the painted face. At the end of the day, I think race is largely exterior.
Yeah, I agree.
But gender is not.
Right.
I mean, God made man and God made woman, and men and women are moral equals, and they're complementary, and they can do a lot of things the same. But there are also some things that are different. And men and women are wired differently, and I think bring different strengths and weaknesses.
Yeah. Let me ask. You just reminded me, I have a biblical question on my radio show every week. And the purpose of the biblical question is to get people to think for themselves, know thyself, and know that you know, not because someone said it, but you can see it for yourself. And so this week, my biblical question is, did the woman come from God or from man? And you say?
The woman came from God, but in some mystical way that I frankly don't understand. The Bible talks about God making Eve out of the rib of Adam. And I confess I don't know what that means. But it does seem to mean that there is some relationship between woman and man that God... However, I believe at the same time that men and women are equally accountable to God and under God's judgment in the same way, and have the same capacity not only for intellect but for moral action.
Are you missing a rib?
You know, if I went to medical school, I could probably answer that one a little bit better. You know, I think we, right, I think grasping these, some of these biblical truths require a really a deep understanding to figure out. I mean, when you read Augustine on the Bible, you see how Augustine recognized that the Bible is a very complex mixture of story, history, moral example, parable, and being able to separate these things out and distinguish one from the other takes a lot of wisdom and study.
It does.
And prayer.
It really does. My heart breaks for black Americans because when I was growing up, most blacks at the time, it was unheard of for abortion. Out of wedlock birth was embarrassing, so it was rare. Blacks respected one another and others. And today, not all, but most blacks are suffering due to the destruction of the family and the lack of moral character. How do you see the state of black Americans?
Well, first of all, a little historical note. Blacks are, as a group, real American heroes because no one would have thought that after slavery, blacks could have, in the 20th century, created a community in which the family would be restored as an institution, in which blacks would have entrepreneurial businesses, in which blacks would pursue education, even under difficult conditions of segregation, the Depression, and so on. But blacks did this. Even though the family was legal in no slave community, no slave state allowed the family among the slaves, the fact of the matter is that by the 100 years ago, in the early 20th century, 75% to 80% of African Americans had nuclear families.
Yeah.
So the breakdown of the black family is not due to slavery. This is, again,
right,
part of the progressive myth.
Yeah.
Slavery destroyed the black family. No, slavery did not destroy the black family. The black family essentially went into a tailspin starting in the 1960s. And the illegitimacy rate for African Americans went from 25% to about 75%, which is where it is now. Now, in fairness, the white rate went up too. The white rate is now up to 33%, which is much higher than it was for African Americans in the 60s. So this is a national problem for sure. But I think the brunt of the destructive effect of progressive policies has been felt more on African Americans than on any other group.
Yeah.
And this is why the Democrats bear a heavy burden of genuine shame, none of which they actually feel.
And one of the reasons that they've been able to destroy the black family is that they went after the man first. They told the black man that you can't be in the home when the government became the daddy of the family with Lyndon B. Johnson. That's what I remember. And so the black men would either hide or leave the homes, and the women would start receiving welfare checks and things like that. And now the black man, the women are just having babies just to get the checks, generation after generation. So my question is, I noticed that men, especially straight, white, conservatives, Christian men of power today, are under attack. The man is the most hated species on this side of heaven. Do you agree with that? And if so, do you know why that is?
I mean, now we're, that's a very profound question, and I don't know if I can do full justice to it. I will say that I think that traditional masculinity is definitely under attack.
Yeah.
Traditional masculinity was always recognized to be a mixed blessing. And by that I mean a patriarchal family could be oppressive or it could be decent. Manliness can lead to militarism and war and conquest, but it can also lead to courage and strength and character.
Yeah.
And so the old task was always about bringing about the best of masculinity. But the progressive left today wants to get rid of that masculinity completely.
Yes.
Their ideal is Trudeau, the metrosexual man who, you know, carries a flower. and to blur the line between the genders, which I don't think is a good thing for men or women.
Right. I realize the reason that men are hated, and I know for a fact, had not the black man left his family, black people would be still doing very well in life because he was in charge, right? The reason that the man is hated because there's a spiritual order to life, and that order is God and Christ, Christ and man over woman, and woman over children. And so love comes from above, through God, through Christ, through the man, to the woman and children. And the men are the spiritual head, protection of their families. And Eva understands that if they could get rid of the Christ, it's easy to take over the women and children. And that's what happened to black men, and I see now that they're trying to do it to the white man. Get rid of him, make him look like a bad guy, a rapist, or an abuser, and all that, and turn his family away from him, they can take over the women and children.
So I'll put this a little different way. Lincoln had predicted in the 1850s that what the Democrats wanted to do, he said, was to turn all of America into a plantation. Now, today when historians look at that, they say, well, Lincoln was exaggerating, because you know, who thinks that slavery would have gone to the North? But what Lincoln really meant is that the Democrats were the party of oppression, and if they could, they would reduce everyone to servitude, right? Now, right now, the Democrats have black ghettos, they have Latino barrios, they have Native reservations. They don't really have the Asian Americans yet, but they've got a lot of the Asian American leadership.
Yes.
Because the Asian Americans go to universities, right? And they try to assimilate. They don't realize they're assimilating to the progressive culture of the left.
Yes.
So they start mouthing all this nonsense that they don't even live and they don't believe, but they know, they feel it's the right thing to say.
Yes.
But where the Democrats don't have is they don't have the white guy.
Yes.
They don't have the white guy.
That's right.
Now, they, ironically, they used to have the white guy because working class white guys were part of the FDR coalition.
Yes.
They were. But they lost him.
Yeah.
And they're losing him in droves right now. Trump won working class counties in Ohio and Mahoning County and Trumbull County that Obama won earlier, and no Republican had ever even competed in those counties. And Trump took them.
Yes.
And if the election were held now, he would take them by a bigger margin.
Yes.
So the Democrats are losing, but if the Democrats could, if they could create a white plantation to match all the other ethnic plantations, their job would be complete.
That's
right. And Lincoln's dire prophecy would be fulfilled.
Tell the folks why they should see the death of a nation.
So, you know, 100 years ago, Woodrow Wilson showed a movie in the White House. It was a pro-Ku Klux Klan movie.
Oh, yeah.
It was called Birth of a Nation.
Yeah.
Now, the point of the title of Birth of a Nation was simply this, that the founders got it wrong, America was ill-founded, we, the progressives, are starting America again. This is the birth of America. And their idea of a great birth of America was the Ku Klux Klan.
Yeah.
They were the heroes of the movie, right? So the theme of our movie is that if the democratic experiment plays out and you let it keep going, it will create the death of the nation. Now, when I say the death of the nation, I have to pause because normally a nation can only be killed by conquest, right?
Right.
But I think a nation can be killed another way, and by, that is by losing its personality, by losing what makes it it. Just like if someone were to take you, Jesse Lee Peterson, and strip away your moral character, strip away your personality, they would make a robot out of you. And outwardly, you'd be the same, but you wouldn't be you.
Absolutely.
And you would be dead in that sense. So this is how the Democrats are trying to kill America. That's the meaning of Death of a Nation. So if you go to deathofanationmovie.com, you can watch the trailer. Movie's opening nationwide in 1,000 theaters. There's a book of the same title. I'm telling you, these days they use on social media the phrase walk away. But if Democrats saw this movie, and the left will try their best to make sure that never happens,
I know.
They would walk away from the Democratic
Party.
It's
an amazing movie. Very, very enlightening. My final question, did you have fun?
It's been great. Thank you very much. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's covered ground that is not covered in a normal interview.
Yes.
And also the ability to expand beyond the political and talk a little bit about the moral and spiritual sphere, that's also quite rare.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you so much for tuning in, folks. I absolutely appreciate it. Don't forget to like, follow, tweet, subscribe, comment. Telephone, telegraph, tell your mama. Have a good day. Thank you. Thanks for watching The Fallen State. We need your continued support. Donate to my nonprofit here. Subscribe and like the videos here. And tell everybody and their mama about the show.